So from the pure bloodline perspective, let's say from the Anjou, for example, they would be looking for raising somebody from childhood, being initiated into the secret societies from childhood. They would be an adept before they're a teen. They're not allowed to take an adept title until they're 25 or 30, and that they would be at Mensa level and have all of the occult knowledge.
By their fruits, you shall know them. By their fruits. By their fruits. By their fruits. By their fruits. By their fruits, you shall know them.
All right, welcome to Buy Their Fruits. This is episode 58. We got Gary Wayne coming on tonight to talk about the Committee of 300. I am with my co-host, John. How you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Jeremy. Great to be back, and great to have Gary back as well, of course.
Yes, sir. Yeah, this is going to be awesome. I know how this is going to go. Gary, I'm sure everybody knows who you are, but if they don't, do you want to just give a little background about yourself, and we'll have you promote your new book now, and then we'll do it again at the end.
Yeah, so thank you for inviting me back to your show, and so happy to be here to talk to your audience about the Committee of 300 tonight. So for people who aren't familiar with me, I've wrote a book called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. And I go deep into the secret societies and how it connects into the bloodlines and into the giants and how the whole world works in book one. So it's a big part of book one. And then I wrote book two. And in case we've got a camera out there that we're using, that's book two. And it's called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, How Understanding Prehistory and Giants Helps to Define End Time Prophecy. And there's some significant differences between the two books. Book one was written from a strong Christian biases, but kind of how the Bible intersects to the world, parallel accounts of prehistory, history, and what's going on today and what they plan for the future. And so it has a lot of testimony in their own words so that Christians can get a good feel for the enemy that we're up against and how they look at prehistory and what they're going to plan to do. And so Christians got a hold of me and said, you know, we really liked it because it just opened our eyes to so many different things. But what we would really like is somebody to take that type of research and apply it to the Bible completely and tell us everything that there is you can sort of imagine that might be in there about prehistory, the angelic order, the fallen angels, the hierarchy of both sides, the giants, the hybrid giants, and anything else that you think is important about prehistory. And then because you talk so much about prophecy as well, how does that connect into end time prophecy? So this book is as unique as book one, but in a different way. And so it's like Genesis 6 part one on steroids. And it's also, if people are familiar with Dr. Heiser, and his work, this is like Heiser on steroids. There is no other book out there that explains things not taught in the church, like prehistory and prophecy and how it relates to the values that were taught in churches. There's no book like out there that's like this. And I would encourage people to, if you want to understand the Bible better, if you want to understand things that are talked about in the Old Testament, you want to bring it to life, this is going to do it in a way that you have not imagined before. And there are way more hybrids and there are way more giant nations than what most people think.
Wow, that was probably the best promotional I've ever heard in my life. That's great. Your first book, I read your first book and it was amazing. It's basically an encyclopedia. And so I couldn't imagine. And I know that the second book is basically focused more towards Christians, right?
Yes.
And yeah, so I think that's going to be a great resource for the body of Christ, man. And, you know, I hope God blesses us for you. And yes, that book goes far and wide, man. That's for sure.
Well, thank you. It's doing fairly well out of the gate. You know, I don't really get true updates until The publisher sends it a couple times a year, but it looks like there's been several productions runs on it already. So, and it's got, this morning it was 46 ratings on it on Amazon. So 44 of them are 5-star. One is 4-star. They wanted a little bit larger font, was the 4-star. And then there's a 2-star and there's no comment. So I'm not sure what they didn't like about it, but maybe they just don't, maybe they're not Christian, or maybe they just don't want to have anything to do with Genesis 6.
Yeah, they're probably a troll, to be honest with you. Probably a
well,
troll.
Then they should have given me a 1-star then. They should have done it proper.
They couldn't quite, because they knew that there was at least, you know, they liked some part of the books. So they couldn't give you 1-star, so they gave you 2.
Right. Yeah, it's a really interesting rating for sure.
That's funny. So I don't know how you want to do this or where you want to start, but I know that if we just give you the mic, you're going to run with it. So wherever you'd like to start, Gary.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what you've covered with your audience about the Committee of 300, but I think probably the best or both place to start might be is where do they fit in the order of things, so that people might get a better idea how important this organization is. And so one of the things I didn't do in book one was sort of give the hierarchy to the committees. I just presented in a way where I'm not trying to get stuck into a hierarchical model. And, you know, at that time I knew there was the pyramid models and all these other models, and I knew there was a model, but I didn't want to sort of get that far because I also had to deal with some other things in book two that I didn't cover off on secret society. So I left that for book two, and it's called a thalamic tree. And if people aren't familiar with that, the word thalem comes out of Greek in the New Testament for God's will. Now, in the KJV, it's also translated erroneously a couple of times to deal with sex and orgies, which is part of the understanding of do as thou will in polytheism. And so if people are familiar with the Rosicrucians and the thalemic ideology that comes out of there, that's kind of based around it. But they have two trees. One's a genealogical tree, which is generally understood as an elm tree. Also, could you substitute as an ash tree or an oak tree, that they keep their genealogies of their bloodlines, because the secret societies were started by the royals and they still control it at the upper levels. And even at the lower levels on Freemasonry as an entry level, people are invited because they have a genealogy or a blood type that they've traced or they've kept, and they want to bring them back in, and they have an opportunity to move up and participate in the activities of the secret societies, but they have to be invited. So when we look at the thalamic tree, understand it as an evergreen tree. And in their allegory, the cedar of Lebanon. And if that sounds familiar, that's what the Amorites in Amos 2 are compared to, just as they're strong as oak trees, which could be translated as ash or elm as well, because they're kind of synonymous in what they use the thalamic genealogical tree for. And of course, those are on Mount Hermon. And so with the giant cedar tree of Mount Hermon, it has this evergreen. So evergreen is the allegory for immortal, just as the genealogical tree typically is a hardwood tree or deciduous tree, and the leaves would fall off and then it comes back to life. And that's sort of allegorical for them for reincarnation. So, and it has both sort of beliefs attached to it, and it's the same as the world tree in the occult. And it's important because if you understand the ideology of the polytheists, they believe that their gods live in heaven, but not in the heaven where the God of the Bible lives, in the third heaven, but in the earth, in Hades or Sheol, other world, Argatha. They have 1,000 different names for it around the world. And that's their heaven, and it's in another dimension. So these trees go into the earth and receive their genes, bloodlines, for the genealogical tree, and then for the evergreen tree, they're the source of the power and the divine right to rule because they're the spurious offspring. So as you look at this tree, you have a large trunk, and then you have all of these branches. So you have what they call the thalamic trunk branches, and you have all of these branches intersecting with those trunk organizations, and that they have a hierarchy within that branch as you go down, and there's a central branch organization that would be at the head of all organizations underneath. And then at that branch, where it branches out from the trunk, that's the main organization that would attach itself to the trunk organization that it's responsible for. So you can look at the main order of this thalamic tree as Freemasonry at the bottom, Illuminati above that in the trunk, Rosicrucians above that, and that's the intersection of the pure bloods with the sort of lower, lesser bloodlines that have come up through Freemasonry and the Illuminati, and then into the Rosicrucians. But the top half is populated by the bloodline royales above that, and they supply 50% of that order at the senior level. So above that level is the Committee of 300 families, and I'll come back to that. And then you have the Council of 33 families, and then the 13 families of the Western European bloodlines. And that's the general hierarchy of the Western. And there would be a similar kind of hierarchy in other places around the world where you have other bloodlines, and they would be working in partnership at times, but also in that bloodline sort of rival that they have. So this is organization that is very much centered on the money in the world. So you can imagine groups like all of the banking organizations would intersect into the Committee of 300. You would have the Rothschilds interconnecting into that level. You would have even the Vatican banking through the Montesa order that is in Jesuit control because of that transition at the time of Francis Borgia took the banking to Switzerland, and that would intersect in. So more modern organizations like the IMF would be connected in there. The World Bank would be connected in there. Projects on cryptocurrency connect in there. The Davos community connect in there.
The Club of Rome?
The Club of Rome likely connects into there. Some people might say the Council of 33. I tend to connect them more into the Committee of 300, and there'd be different levels of that.
Yes.
So, for example, you know, you would have like the bloodlines of the Dutch that are typically I'm sorry, I was confusing that with the Bilderberger, but it would be the same idea in the Bilderberger Society that connects in the Committee of 300. Mm-hmm. Powerful bloodlines like the Dutch royal bloodline of Orange would be at the top of the senior order. And then you would have other lower bloodline new money people coming in to the Bilderberger meeting, like Bill Gates and you know, the Clintons, you name the ones, but then you have to be invited to go there, and you get your marching orders there every year to go do your part in the agenda. In return, their offspring typically are going to be able to intermarry into the bloodlines and move up into the hierarchy. In the Club of Rome, for example, you had Pierre Trudeau when I was growing up, and they showed it on CBC television, which was the national news, showed him going into, I saw it twice as a child, going into the Club of Rome. And then that whole sort of media attention disappeared. And the Club of Rome was created to speed up the globalization process in the 1960s, and Pierre Trudeau was elected in 1968, and so he was part of it just before he comes to power, surprise surprise. And then he marries Margaret Sinclair, a bloodline from the Sinclair of the Freemasonry founders, and the St. Clair and the Rollo bloodline of the Norse. So there's always that sort of intersection that's going on. And You're also going to have other societies like the Jesuits that tend to link in to, not the Jesuits, the Knights of St. John that will link into the Committee of 300. I think initially the Jesuits would have linked it into the Rosicrucians because they're sponsored by the Rosicrucians before they develop the lower societies. So that was at that time would still have been the Council of 33, and then they added the 300 families, and then they added the Rosicrucians and maintained that name. And because the Black nobility sponsored the Jesuits, both before and after, but two different levels, it gets to be interesting where they might sort of intersect. So the original, let's say, Julia or Fabia gens of the Black nobility of Italy, who were supplying popes and like the Borgias and others, all throughout the history, that would have been part of the Council of 33. But when the Jesuits were taken down in the 1800s and then restarted in about 1870 to 80, they were sponsored at that time by the lower Black nobility versus the senior Black nobility. And that's a group that moved into Venice and Florence and places like that. So banking and merchants like the Medicis, who came over from Phoenicia and migrated over there and established. So there's two different genses, that sort of the Romulus and Remus genses that come down through history through the senator families and Augustus and Caesar and others. And then there's this newer but still an older gens from another set of bloodlines from the Middle East. So it's a very, very important group because it controls all the, the World Trade Organization answers into there. Anything to do with banking and economics is going to funnel into there because money's everything. Money gives them the power. And they have, and because they control the banking, they have all of this off the books money kept in Switzerland. And even the Rothschilds have moved their banking there. And the banking gets its start with the Knights Templar after their fall, and most of the wealth with the Templars going into Switzerland, where the Knights of St. John are, which is another sister organization, and why it would connect in at the Council of 300, let alone its particularly powerful status at the UN as a sitting member, and its connections to secret society, or not secret societies, but spy agencies and that sort of stuff. So, and so when we look at the organizations that are intersecting into the Committee of 300, we need to look at it that it's controlling the money, and that its money is larger than we can imagine. And so people think that Bill Gates is the richest in the world for a while, and then Elon Musk, and then maybe Bezos, and it's going back and forth. That's a drop in the bucket. And the money that is held in literally a fortress country with the mountains, where they have all the major banking centered today. When I was doing research on book one on, what does that money look like, I would get numbers in about, let's see. I think the year was about 2000 or 2001 when I got that information, and it was consistently coming from a number of sources. Somewhere at that time between 300 and 500 trillion was off the books. So all the wealth that you might see by the royal bloodlines isn't the real money. The real money is hidden, and they can bring that money out anytime they want. So if they wanted to do a global reset, they could take away all the cash of even the people like Elon Musk. And it's a drop in the bucket. And then they would fund people like Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Bezos and all of these oligarchs after the Great Reset. And they would be even more rich and powerful very shortly after because you'd have reduced competition all around the world. And the humans, the lower level, the middle class and lower, I mean, you will own nothing, right? So that's where all of those types of policies on the global scale comes from, is the Committee of 300 families. So that's sort of an opening. So I'll let you guys in there because I covered a lot of material.
Gary, to your point that you just mentioned earlier, Would you say that the hidden wealth, if we're going from like the Great Reset to what I call the controlled Great Reset to the fake Great Awakening, if you have like the system, because there's many different ways that you could interpret like the people that take the mark of the beast, like what is Satan going to promise them, right? And the New Agers, especially within the modern realm, whether it's Bailey or Barbara Marx Hubbard, would write about kind of like this, Saint Germain trust in that, when people take the mark, and you'll see that in the Nisarga Gasara, the false pushing of that, where if you have like a binder full of your intentions, right? And then, you'll be given these, if you have your Zimbabwe dollars or your Iraqi dinar, somehow you'll have wealth above your like wealth above your dreams as you could think of, as long as you do what you've written in those binders, right? So we've been told in conspiracy cultures, in Christian, even in Christian conspiracy cultures for years, that when the Antichrist comes in, and I do believe, obviously, for believers who don't take the mark, that we won't be able to buy or sell. We'll probably be separate out of the financial system. I do honestly believe that. But I would argue that for the people who do take the mark and do buy in through this, massive wealth where there might be a one world currency based off of commodities, which their leader's saying, based off of all the wealth on the world instead of like a fiat currency backed by nothing. Do you think that that could play a role in some, like all the wealth that they have play a role in some sort of mark of the beast financial system in the future, where one of the pros of taking the mark is to be able to have access to wealth?
Yes, in different sort of segments. So that wealth is going to be used to, as we talked about, to refund the reset, however that comes about. How many times that might come about, it's going to be used to fund the wars that are going to come about because of it, so that they can still be in power. And there's a lot of rivals around the world. They don't have China on side. They don't have Russia on side. They may not have Trump on side, maybe on some things, but not on most things. And all of those places and others will demand a larger position in this new globalist state that the Western Europeans want to bring on. So there's going to be a lot of sort of fallout from that. So I would anticipate probably two financial systems as we see developing right now, one in the East, one in the West. People talk about the BRIC nations, but really you're looking at China, Russia, India, and you might want to add in maybe Germany down the road out of need, just like India buys all of their energy from Russia. And there'll be a third player, might be Persia, but that could be included with India. So there'd be another player that would go in there. They already have their own banking, their own credit cards, their own cryptocurrency. They're buying and exchanging in non-US dollars already. So they're already creating that rival. So at some point in time, that'll have to merge to get to the major world system called the Babylon system, that they call it, that they say technically is in place today, but it's not the model yet that they want to get to. And that is the precursor to the Antichrist Beast or Mark system, and they call that the Leviathan system. And so that's where they want to get to. So at that point in time, when Babylon is in power, it controls all of the world trade. So there's going to be a large religious component that's going to be part of that as well, just by inference, as the woman riding the beast and controlling the 10 kings. And so that's going to come, and that's going to not be distributed equally, the wealth there. What they're going to do is reinstate the four class system, or the feudal system as it was called in Europe. And in that class system, you have the bloodlines and the nobility elite, which is the larger family that control the first two classes. And so you have the governing class, and like the royals, and you have the priest class, and you have the oligarch class, you have the military class. And then you have, a couple levels in that sort of hierarchy. And so they're going to populate the top two classes. The middle class is going to drop down to the way it was before. Very, very small, and just enough tailors, bakers, blacksmiths on a more modern sort of understanding, who will be small free enterprise, but not, you know, affecting the oligarch system that they want to bring in, and they're doing it through the corporations to do that. And the corporations are a what I would call as a degradation or a crime against free enterprise, and it's introduced by the real money to achieve what they want to do globally. And so then you're going to have the basically slave or working class that's just working for their daily wage. And so you might see that coming to its fruition with some of the wars and things that are going on, where you're working for a day's wages, as Revelation 6 talks about. And there's more destruction to come after that. By the time the mark of the beast comes in, is it's there is room for that small class again. There really isn't any room for the lower class except for rituals and slave labor. And if you don't take the mark, we're going to kill you and remove you from the face of the earth. So it's a one step up after that, but it comes complete with the complete angelic interdimensional technology that would come along with it. And all of the things that they're talking about at Davos is planning for the first level at Babylon that's in place for, so Antichrist can take it over and then just take it to one more level up.
So when they're promising you the great wealth transfer, it's not going to come to Christians, obviously, even though
No,
you
it's
have
not.
a lot of prosperity preachers saying it's going to come to Christians. But you're also getting the health as well too, with the promises of cures and med bed technology that's been seeded in science fiction culture, as you well know. You know, Stargate, Star Trek, for decades. You know, they're setting up people for that beast system.
And you know, Davos has been active in saying that this chip implant system is going to come about through the delivery system of healthcare. That because it will also connect you into the beast system, it will also connect you into the healthcare system, and it will supply the digital technology, you know, kind of on a base level as to what mRNA might do, but this would be significantly more advanced. That
That's
just
true.
comes through the chip from this angelic technology. That you'll do, you'll they'll demand that because of the pestilence. They'll demand that to have immortality in the physical world, and they want more knowledge and, you know, of the occult and things like that. So that's what this implant will be designed to do. And to do that, they need to have all of those technology lanes, whether it's crypto, quantum computing, AI, everything that's going on to hit a nexus point to come together. And so in January, the Davos crew, and they're working together almost in partnership now with the G20. So there's been a step up with in terms of the money and the support that the Davos crew is doing. And so there needs to be further advancement of AI, which was their stumbling block. It's not where it needs to be, and that's why they did the double down on AI. And
Do you think that's why they're free sourcing it to people to have them all use it at once in the hope that the artificial intelligence can gain knowledge that way? Kind of
yeah,
like
collect all the data.
experimentalism.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wonder if you thought, Gary, of that was, you know, the reason why they're open source, like open source, you know, it to everyone. To kind of get them to interact with it, to kind of get them on the hook with it.
It's like everything. You if you were to introduce AI at its peak of its ability, everybody would say that's got to go, right? So you have to introduce it over time and get people used to it. And there's a process to all of that. And it's way slower than they would have anticipated for
That is true.
acceptance. You know, they've been talking about the cashless society since I was very, very young, and maybe even before that. And, you know, and everybody thought, you know, the credit card system was going to be that. And then the combination of credit cards and the UPC system. And I think all of that's base technology for it, but quite primitive, sort of compared to the mRNA technology that's digital medicine sending messages, is just sort of a precursor and baseline of where they want to move forward with that technology. So it's taken a lot more time, and they've had that whole premise on how they would introduce the cashless society through the credit cards in place for over 25 years. And they just can't get over the hump that people still want some sort of anonymity. And now they've created other issues with all this other technology. Now they have a major security issue.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where crypto has to come in and get to another level. And you saw the reserve banks, which also answer into as part of the banking association and the Rothschilds into the Committee of 300. They need to have a cryptocurrency that can work in all dimensions and that can't be cracked. And so it needs to be invisible in terms of its security. So it needs more advancement on the Daemon algorithms and that interdimensional sort of capability. So it has to be there that they can manipulate the system any way they want, but nobody else can go in and take their wealth. So until that's resolved, we don't get the crypto in a way. But it's interesting that, you know, last fall, the reserve banks around the world stepped in to take over crypto. And Canada was supposed to introduce cryptocurrency this year, and they backed right away from it. Why? They don't have the AI thing solved yet. They don't have the crypto thing solved in multiple dimensions yet.
They got to do it before Q Day happens, right? I mean, that's when all encryption is pretty much rendered useless at that point, at least they say.
Yeah.
And I guess to your point, one last thing, I know, Jeremy, you want to get in here and say something, is the darling for Bilderberg for the past year or two is Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel's very much in with Founders Fund, building the Beast system, you know, brick by brick with Anderson and Horowitz. I mean, he's literally, there's companies he's funding. I forgot the name of the company, but they're literally putting organs on computer chips.
Yeah.
So they can run simulations with them. You know, it's crazy. Yeah,
exactly. Well, and it needs to be done because you have Elon Musk working on the Neuralink.
Yep.
Right. So, and that's got to go both directions. The Neuralink's got to work with other parts in the body on that sort of technology. And it has to create the hive mind that Davos was talking about, that they see in 5 to 10 years that people will be able to communicate through these types of Neuralinks. And they're going to recreate that whole hive ideology that they believe they had once when the bloodlines were pure from the giants, and that they could communicate through telepathy. So they're like, they're trying to create a technological hive mind that the giants once had.
Now, so we talked about AI for a little bit, and we talked about just for a brief moment about the Antichrist. And I just had it's kind of an obscure question, I guess, related to the topic, but in your opinion, do you see, I'll preface this way. So we see like the World Economic Forum and the Young Global Leaders Program and how Trudeau and Bill Gates and many, many other famous people have come out of the Young Global Leader programs to literally be indoctrinated and basically groomed to be a leader of the world. Do you think, in your opinion, that the Antichrist will come out of a system like that, like will be basically groomed to be the world's leader eventually? And my second question real quick is, do you think that the whole AI problem that they're having right now is because they haven't associated like quantum computing with the entire system yet? Like, I know they're working on quantum computing and they're trying to perfect that, but eventually they're going to have to integrate it if they're going to want, you know, if they're going to have all this data from the world, you know, billions of people. They'll need a to do that.
Yeah, and I'll take the second question first and come back to the first question. So you've had quantum computing working with AI in places like CERN for almost 2 decades. And they're still not there yet either. And again, the thought is it's the AI that's the weak link, and it's not where it needs to be to do what they want it to do. So I think that has a ways to go yet. But, you know, they're developing this knowledge faster than we can imagine. You know, there used to be a time where they said, you know, our knowledge would double every 100 years and then 50 years. And then in the 90s, it was every 5 years. I'm wondering how fast the knowledge base doubles today with the invention of supercomputers and all the other things that they've added to it. So it probably isn't that far down the road, but they're not there yet. We don't know how exactly how long it will take them to get there. All we know is they're very, very frustrated because they're dependent on it. Everything has to be in place for that, for them to do what they want to do. So, yeah, work for that convergence as stepping it up. And there may be other issues, but I'm not really getting wind of it. Not that I work from the inside, but usually you get things that you can connect if you're watching around. And it just seems to be it's the AI that's not working the way that it ought to be used. So in
Right.
terms of grooming leaders, they do. They groom two sets of leaders, lower level leaders and then the bloodline leaders. So Trudeau groomed as a leader, for example, or Clinton was groomed. That's not an Antichrist type figure. From the bloodline perspective. So from the pure bloodline perspective, let's say from the Anjou, for example, they would be looking for raising somebody from childhood, being initiated into the secret societies from childhood. They would be an adept before they're a teen. They're not allowed to take an adept title until they're 25 or 30, and that they would be at Mensa level and have all of the occult knowledge. And in the European bloodlines, whether or not they're working together on it, there's three different ones from three different bloodlines or three within specific bloodlines. They keep three ready to go for every generation. So when they, as they see it, they would want to have an Antichrist come from their royal bloodline. Now there's rivals to that, and they would be preparing rivals as well, and not just in Europe, but around the world from some of the rivals. So, could there be a strong man that comes along or a surprise? Perhaps, probably not likely, but it could be possible. But you're going to have the support of these bloodlines and the 10 kings when they come to power. And they're going to hand power over to Antichrist because they are so jealous of Babylon, who's grown rich through the Babylon system. And it's Antichrist who introduces, as they would call it in the occult, or the great monarch, or the grand monarch, I guess is what they like to call them, that would introduce what they call the Leviathan system. So, yeah, we need to be aware that they're always ready, but there will be challenges. And so Jesus warned us, and it's supported in the epistles of John, that there will be multiple antichrists. And then there's going to be an antichrist that antichrist has to take credit for defeating. So therefore, there has to be a counterfeit Armageddon. And so there has to be a true rival that's going to deceive the elect, if that were possible, so that he can deceive the world that he is the Messiah and do that before the coming of Jesus. So that's the time frame that they're working on. So it's going to get really confusing with multiple antichrists and rival bloodlines. I know a lot of people are looking at King Charles III. Well, that would be another legitimate bloodline. Probably not Charles, but maybe William, because of age with Charles and things still need to be a lot of things built. But they're way more than that. I mean, there's the King of Jerusalem title that's held by the Bourbon bloodline in Spain that was inherited through intermarriage over the last couple of hundred years. And his father had the title before him, but it comes through the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty and then back to through the Anjou bloodlines. And even with them having what they say is the legitimate King of Jerusalem title, there are two rivals within the Anjou bloodline that say they have the legitimate right to that King of Jerusalem title. So you have the Savoy out of the Naples Anjou, who are the kings of Italy, and then you have the von Habsburg, who claims that he has the right, he should be the rightful King of Jerusalem. But what's interesting is that there are two orders of the Golden Fleece. One is controlled by the King Philippe Bourbon of Spain, that Queen Elizabeth sat at the table at. within that Royal Masonic organization. So one presumes Charles would be part of that as well. Now, that doesn't mean that the Windsor family wouldn't make their own claim, but they would be in more of an alliance against the Lorraine Habsburg order of the Golden Fleece, that they have a rival Royal Masonic order that they're part of. So, you know, at the top where you have these families, they have branch organizations and Royal Masonic orders left, right, and center as well. It's just part of the whole hierarchy.
Yeah, that makes sense too. And but even if, like, as you were saying, there's some rivalry going on there, even if, say, one of the bloodlines didn't produce the Antichrist that God ordains to be the Antichrist, I'm sure that one of the 10 kings will come out of one of the royal bloodlines. And we know that the Antichrist eventually takes out like three of the kings.
Yes.
You know,
and probably and,
prob-
and likely replaces them by implication too in other passages. So puts vassal kings in place.
Now, speaking about the leaders, and I know we're going to get back to the Committee of 300, but according to the Bible, there's principalities and powers behind the nations, right?
Yep.
In your opinion, and I never really thought about this this way until today, but do you think that some of the leaders that are running, for example, like if you get to the top of the Committee of 300 and stuff, or the top of the people running behind the scenes of certain nations, do you think that they're inhabited by these principalities, or do you think they're just in communion with them in the sense of like communication?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So, and I understand there's the, you know, fallen angels, and then there's also the demons, right, that they would be communicating with. I think they communicate mostly with the demons, but as we get closer to the end time, I think there's going to be other angels that they would, fallen angels that they would communicate with. And you could have an avatara effect that could be going on with these 10 kings, and particularly it will be with Antichrist, as Satan is going to give his power to Antichrist, as is he does the false prophet to deceive people. So do I think at the royal bloodline level that they're communicating often? Absolutely. And they could be bringing in demon spirits that they could control with their rituals, as they would say, or key words that would add some power to them or wisdom. Typically, a avatar effect would be more symbiotic, in that it would just add powers to them. And so you get that understanding out of the Eastern religions, particularly where it's clear, where Vishnu, for example, avatared many times into an avatara. Buddha was one of them. That's why you look at one of the allegorical titles for Antichrist coming would be the new Buddha or Lord Maitreya. It's with that avatar relationship. And that there is a connection, though, to the council of gods. And that each of the bloodlines have a connection back to a specific visible patriarch, as in a Nephilim or a Raphaim, and maybe some Sion bloodlines, as most of the dynasties have, to enhance their nobleness, but also back to a specific celestial mafia godfather. And if you look at the fallen angels, but I like the name Celestial Mafia Godfather, tongue in cheek. And so they would receive power through them and receive the divine right to rule through the Council of the Gods, which rules over the 70 nations, as described in Deuteronomy 32, understanding that that number comes from Exodus 1:5, and there's 70 patriarchs in the nations listed in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 and 1 Chronicles, and that by inference, Adam had 70 sons as well, even though they're not all listed, that would have been patriarchs for those nations. And it's important to understand that, because as you look at the understanding of the hierarchy of the gods, and the council of the gods, there's rank and order. They have a host, just as there's a loyal host of heaven. And the word host is Saba in Hebrew, means an army of angels. So you have a hierarchy there. And You know, when the parent gods were removed and sent to the pit prison, and then the offspring gods were sent to the pit prison after the flood, other ones moved up in order. And so you have a rank and an order that's connected underneath Satan, under the seven major gods. And then however many are in that council. And some people think there's, as many as 70 gods in the Council of Nations. But you could also look at it from bloodlines that are represented into that council as well. So there may be a couple different levels to it. So, and why I go there is that name the Committee of 300, families. And they take that out of Greek mythology and the hierarchy of Mount Olympus and its assembly of the gods, of the Olympian gods. And that word hierarchy means sacred ruling or sacred assembly of rulers, is where you get that for hierarchy coming out. And I cover that sort of etymology off in book two for people to have a better understanding of the council of the gods. And so that committee of 300 in some of their allegories has several different sort of meanings, but the most important meaning it is that it symbolizes the 300 angels that are at the top 300 level of gods around the earth. So there's a hierarchy of 300, and those would be understood as the celestial mafia godfathers. Now, I understand we're only told about 200 that first created giants. I don't know how they necessarily arrive at 300, but they take that understanding for the name of the committee out of Greek history and mythology. And it has some interesting sacred numbers to it in terms of the three and the two zeros. I won't bother people with all of that. But these are the 300 angels that are going to rule the new Eden as part of that council of the gods, as they would like it. And that's why in the New Age occult, they're always talking about the taking it back to the state of Eden, but a new Eden versus an old Eden that would be the whole earth. And in Greek, 300 was the number of guards that would surround a king. So as you look at that sort of as in the invisible ones versus the visible ones, you would have 300 protecting and surrounding Satan that sits atop of the Council of Gods, right? And so Pythagoras and his mystery schools would take 300 disciples at one time. You had the battle of the 300, whether it's all accurate or not in terms of the numbers and how the battle took place was between Greek and Persia, right? That is a very important number to the Greeks. And so I think it's probably representative of how that hierarchy works under through the Council of the Gods. You can also use, in the book of Enoch to get to a certain level into the number of nations, you have the chief of tens. So the chief of tens are basically essentially the seven Satans or the seven major gods underneath Satan. And you multiply that by 10 and you get to 70. So they'd be ruling over the 70 nations, but you also have branch countries. So, I mean, you look at what England did, how many countries that they spawned. So that needs to be represented in terms of how that hierarchy works and why you have the hierarchy that is established between the angels. They'll work within those individual nations and branch nations with the same kind of hierarchy that applies to the angelic order. Because everything that is applied in their heaven is applied on earth.
Yeah, speaking about the Greeks, for just real quick, I wonder if that number 300 that they came up with, because you said that that number was important to the Greeks. We know that there's 12 like major gods, like 12 of the
12 archons, yeah,
yeah, archons. But there's countless demigods as well. You know what I mean? So I wonder if you all together, if it would equal 300, just out of curiosity, but.
Well, the demigods are just giants, so there would have been way more giants, but one might presume that there were 300 bloodlines started through the spurious major giants that, were the firstborn, right? It would all work back in their inheritance rights as well. And so the firstborn would carry the bloodline. But it gets really complicated when you're trying to take that back. And how does that measure up today? Except that they keep their genealogy, so they know where they all fit within those genealogies. And you have many different types of genses that are out there, like the LB gens that I cover off in book one and in book two. You have the Julia gens and the Fabia gens of the Black nobility, one for the warriors and one for the governors that go back to Romulus and Remus. You have the Creta gens, that is the Zeus bloodlines. And after, so there's preferred bloodlines that would be for the more higher up gods. So you have kings that are formed that are called the Gyges kings, or the Gyes in plural after the flood. And they're called Gyges kings because they're giant kings, tyrants, tyrannos, and that they are part of the Herculides bloodline of kings, and which was an upper level of kings, because the Herculides are the descendant bloodlines. And there's multiple kings. They're in Assyria, they're in Greece, they're in Asia Minor, they're in a number of locations where these dynastic bloodlines are ruling as kings as after the flood. And Hercules is the offspring of Zeus in alchemy, a human female. So that's part of the invisible, that's part of the visible hierarchy that we need to understand, that would be connected to the invisible ones, but it would be in the same hierarchical organizational structure.
John, you got anything to add?
Not necessarily to what Gary was saying there. No, but I do find it very interesting you talking about the 12 archons as me being a former Gnostic, how that plays a major lo a role in Greek Gnostic theology and, quote unquote Christian Gnostic theology, as well too. They kind of blended it all together, because around that time you had Jewish Gnosticism, you had Greek Gnosticism, and you had later Christian Gnosticism. And it kind of, like I said, kind of put it, you would have different flavors depending on who you were reading at that time. Because, outside of objectivism, subjectivism, you can just kind of like choose your own Avenger or whatever you want to add to your cosmology, in
Yep.
a lot of ways. But okay, so to go back about Committee 300 question, something you were mentioning earlier is, would you say that the Dutch, like the Dutch, anybody from Denmark, Sweden, would they play a role kind of like in that power structure as well too? Or are you saying it's a primary in England power structure?
Well, England might be more off on their own. They're
Okay.
cooperating, like with the Anjou bloodline, and there's a lot of Anjou, and Plantagenet is a junior offshoot of the Anjou. There's a lot of Anjou blood that went into English kings from about 1000 AD as well. But there's also the Norse bloodlines in there too. So generally, you would go back to the source, and the current bloodline of England today is the Hanover bloodline from Germany, right? So again, you have to sort of get in behind who's running these bloodline thrones. And so out of the Norse bloodlines, or the Odin bloodlines, you had the Rollo clan that did all of the invasions and took Normandy and intermarried and took the throne with William the Conqueror, and supplied De Bruce as the king bloodline for Scotland to intermarry. And so you would have, that's the St. Clair bloodline that would have their own stake in providing their own dragon messiah as well. So yeah, there would be several ones that would be out there that would have a direct source back to a pantheon of gods and the high god.
The reason I would ask is because you mentioned King Charles and kind of like his bloodline, where, I look at Trump's bloodline, because Trump, has relation both to Denmark, which would be King Christian the First, as well as the Scottish bloodline through his mother, kind of like the MacLeod bloodline as well too. And you know, I myself believe that it's quite possible that Trump might be, or someone from his light lineage might be the Antichrist, because of his blood being separate than any other. Because I know it was kind of like the sixth or seventh generation, where remember there was like a girl, I think she was either late middle school or early high school, where she mapped most of all the American presidents in relation to each other, to the kind of like British dynasties.
Yeah,
Okay.
King George.
Yes, and Trump, unlike them, again, you have the Scottish and you have the Danish bloodline, which would separate him as well too. So that's why I was asking, like, as far as like. And then there's a whole other discussion too. I know you mentioned my friend Aaron Falkman from Underground Publishing. We've done a lot of research and trying to figure out, well, who's the lost tribe of Dan? Who are the Danites, right? And they're kind of like some mysticism of whether or not the myth of, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, the myth of Hercules could have actually been, you know, Samson from the years that he wandered off, right? And then he eventually came back. You know, there's kind of like a play of maybe the myth of Hercules was based off of, you know, Samson possibly wandering or not, which I know is a whole other discussion, but
Yeah,
you
well, Her
have.
yeah. Hercules tends to be predating Samson by almost 1,000 years in terms of
Okay.
the historical records. So.
So you have but again, you have like the Danish originally be calling Dan's land Danmark and stuff like that and everything. So I know it's kind of like a series of like rambling there, but I just wanted to get
Well,
your
no,
opinion on
I
it or
think I
not.
get it. So there's always the possibility it's you'll have a strong man with very low bloodlines rise to power that surprises all of these royal bloodlines. That's a possibility. I wouldn't necessarily put odds on that as being likely. But you could imagine somebody like Putin who would have low-level bloodlines through according to his own mythos, being born of the Putyanin bloodline in Kiev through his grandfather, which Putin name comes out of nowhere in about the 1850s. The Putyanin was the original bloodline of the Tsars in Kiev, and they were Scythian, Tuatha Dé Danann. Now, when you're looking at names associated with Dan. I know there's a lot of research by a number of Christian groups that say that that's a possibility that was a migration of Dan, but more likely it's the Tuatha Dé Danann, that those tribes, because they predate that and those names predate. So I would be not looking for that sort of relationship with Dan. Somehow Dan, you know, they come out of Bashan, and that they are part of the religious sort of nature. I'd like to do more research on Dan when I get some time, to try and get a little bit closer to the passages that references Dan, and understanding they're not part of the 144,000. So there's that would suggest they're part of the religious context of the opposing side somehow, some way. So, so I think we have to be aware that the Stuarts have a legitimate claim as well, and still have descendancies. And they had at one time the most ignoble bloodline, and were asserting themselves as the people that would do that. And so, you know, King James Stuart saw himself as an Antichrist figure that wanted to create, with his unicorn dynasty, this great world empire, and that his bloodlines would be the ones that would rule it. That was where he was sort of coming from on that. And yet that, you know, bloodline was replaced in the English throne by the Hanovers. But that Stuart claim is still out there. And he's the one who really made famous the divine right to rule. So I think we want to be careful on trying to name presidents. Every president that comes along as an Antichrist, that's
I
been
know
done with
people
all
did
of the presidents. Yeah. Oh, and they
Obama.
did Bush, and they did them Clinton, they did them all, believe me. And not to get too caught up in the bloodlines that we might think would be the likely ones. They're wannabes for sure, and they may be presenting figures that are going to be some of the Antichrist wannabes, but Until that happens, it's kind of like playing on the roulette table. There's so
Sure.
many of them. And then there's bloodlines like the Xi bloodline, who would love to put himself into power to control the world. And some people would say, okay, that might be one of the strongmen. I would put him on more the royal bloodline side, because he comes from the Western bloodline of the Xia, Xia, dynasty of the Xia dragon empires that came down and was overthrown by the virus by the Western Europeans called communism, and took down that rival bloodline, just like they took down the Romanov junior offshoot of the Putianin bloodline to take Russia down, and that bloodline down, because they thought it was more pure. And so Xi is part of that old dragon empire dynasty. And they certainly have dynastic and empire ambitions, so they may be looking to upset. But I think when we look at Daniel 8, we're kind of looking within the old Greek Empire that included Rome as one part of the four that the Antichrist bloodlines might come out of. And within the Muslim view, they have bloodlines that they would like to present. And they have the Mahdi, and they have a different one for the Shia than the Sunni. So they'll have rival ones. And then you have this Lord Maitreya or Persian bloodlines that are in play. It's going to get very, very confusing. So I don't try and worry as to who it's going to come from, because there's just too many things. And the thing I do try and encourage people to do is not be automatically pointing fingers. And when it comes back to Trump, as what you were posing there is he's kind of like Putin and Xi, is that he's not saying he's against the New World Order. He wants a larger role for the US than what Europeans would like to do. Europeans only want the US as their attack dog. They don't want the US to have real power. And as these 10 groups of nations are forming, the US is likely going to be, heading one of those groups. Now, they may fold in under England somehow, some way. Now that England's broken away from Europe, there may be more of a Commonwealth that actually does form. But I think the US will still have the largest political might there. But there would be, you might want to look for a connection of the bloodlines of the English throne and the presidents there, particularly as we get closer to the end time. So, because there'd have to be that working relationship, or England's part of another empire.
Yeah, I definitely could see that. And we don't know as far as America's prominence or lack thereof in the end times as well too, of whether how strong we will be. Some people think that we may wane as well too as an empire. We might fall apart, maybe be absorbed into the British Empire, some sort of like reestablishing some sort of monarchy, maybe with Canada, maybe some sort of, return to the Commonwealth if there's some sort of destabilization during World War III.
Yeah, if wars start to get stronger, and we'll just sort of speculate and do some scenarios, wars start to get stronger. I mean, the US is as they are today are, unless they go bankrupt with all the spending, which is what kind of part of the plan is to reduce the power of the US. But what's more likely is there's probably a split in the US into one, two, maybe several countries, but two for sure. And Canada would have a choice to make and probably might go with those kinds of splits as well. So you could have a more decentralized set of powers that might be more looking to say, we want to be part of the 10, and we would go with a British Royale to lead that. And so all of that will take some things to happen, including tighter trade and economic relationships with England to start happening, to sort of foreshadow that that's going to be coming about. But catastrophes and wars change everything quickly. So that's the big changer.
Yeah, I mean, we could end up with a fractured. I mean, they're trying to push a civil war to happen here in the United States, which, in my opinion, a fractured union would weaken the United States as a whole and set us up for invasion by our enemies if we enter into a World War III type scenario. I mean, at least from what I see, Russia's very close to Alaska. It's not much of a difference, and you can end up with maybe a return. Like you could have maybe a liberal state, for lack of a better terms, and then you could have a Christian nationalist state rise up.
And it could be done without a war. I mean,
Sure.
at the end of the day, both sides are coming to a conclusion that, and there may be a third side in there too that we don't know, right? But they're basically saying we can't live with each other. And it seems to be getting to be more irreconcilable. But if there is the move to totalitarianism, that'll trigger the war. And I do see that we're moving more towards totalitarianism, and that is what would, to me, be the big thing to trigger the war. But who knows? It could be just say groups of states are going to say, we're leaving. You want to have a war? We'll have a war. But we could negotiate this if you want.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you look into like Project 2025, that's basically a blueprint for American totalitarianism. Like it's basically about taking the FCC and all these other agencies and putting them all under the direct initiative of the President of the United States. So that's kind of interesting because then it incorporates, one man power essentially. And that could just be.
Totally unconstitutional, which could just in itself, as you try and get that to the surface to impose it, is so generally that sort of happens after you seize power, then you can put that into place, but who knows? They may be able to control all the institutions that bring it about. They're very close to doing that today. But I still think, I mean, my gut feeling is, I mean, it can go either way, but my gut feeling is if it goes through that form of totalitarian, there's going to be a civil war, whether it's a long one or not. It's very hard to say we're going to persecute half the people of the country and they're not going to push back on that.
Yeah, and that could be part of their plan. I mean, most likely, right? Because even loyal nationalists in the United States, like they would be totally down for a civil war if it came down to it. So it's another arm of the overall octopus agenda, if you know what I mean. But getting back to the Committee of 300, so obviously I'm not going to have you name all 300 families, but who are some prominent people of the modern day era who are associated with the committee?
And you're not, I mean, you're not going to get a lot of the names, right? Like, you have the Dutch family that's obviously part of that, and they work with the Bilderberg organizations. But the main families of Europe are the Anjou and Plantagenet. So I would classify them in as one. Champagne is a major family. Geyser is a major family. Various houses of St. Clair and Sinclair between French and Scottish and English. But again, they could be classified as one, even though they have different sort of branches. The Habsburg family is obviously another one. Bourbon is obviously one that we met. Brienne. You have the Stuarts you have to be aware of. Obviously, the Windsor Hanover bloodline. You also have out of Italy families like of the lower black nobility like the Medici, but there's also the Orsini, the Colonna, the Messino, Borghese. These are more of the senior bloodline that goes back to the Juliagens that are operating at that level. So those are the larger sort of names, but there could be a few more in there. Like you might include Fontaine, you might include Joinville or Brienne. But again, those would be sort of the main ones that would be getting closer to the top of the Thelemic tree. So some of those would be in the top 13, and some, and probably all of those are in the 33 families.
And do you know possibly because I've heard this family's name mentioned a whole bunch, but it seems to me like they used to be prominent, but I don't know how prominent they are now. But what about the Vanderbilts of the United States? Do you know much about them?
Yeah, that's kind of, it's in there, but it's not significant. But it is connected through, bloodline ancestry. So, and then, they did supply, some major influence at one point in time and some presidents. So, yeah, they're there, but they're kind of in the New World. In the New World, they're considered pseudo blue bloods. So they have considerable ennobling to do to enhance them to be recognized by the purebloods, as they call themselves.
Yeah, they got to get risky to get that respect back.
Yep.
Because
Yep.
I heard that at one point they used to be one of the richest families in America, but they kind of
Yep.
faded away.
Yep.
Yeah, that's interesting. Johnny, got anything to add, buddy?
Did with the Habsburgs, Gary, in your research, did a group called La Cercle ever pop up, which seems to be kind of like the Bilderberg of Europe? Another Bilderberg group of Europe, which is lesser known than the Bilderberg group in and of itself. The Habsburg family seems to have a lot to do with La Cercle. So I didn't know if they popped up any at all in your research.
Yeah, see what, yeah, there are, and I remember seeing that name. I can't say that I've dug into them, but understand that each of the royal bloodlines, they would have their own family Royal Masonic Order, and then there'd be branches of that. So, but to make it simple, you got to get back to kind of the major bloodlines. So lots of those types of, of organizations, like the Montesa Order, is another royal order. They inherited all of the Templar wealth in Spain, that the Bourbon and Bourgeois, Francis Bourgeois, he managed it as a Grand Master of the Montesa Order, but it was set up by the Bourbon family to control that organization. And that's part of that hierarchy again. And it's the Montesa Order that funded through Borgia the Jesuit Order and brought them to power. And through that avenue, got control of the banking. So there's all sorts of those types of royal orders that are out there. From each family, like the order of the Garter in England, and there's the one that everybody's sort of aware of that ex-prime ministers sort of get named to, and they're not really part of the royal order. That's the royal blood order. It would be equivalent at that top level to the order of the Golden Fleece or the order of the Seraphim of the Norse bloodline.
Yeah, the Pilgrim Society as well too. Like, there's so many groups that they splinter off, and we'll never truly know.
Where and
Kind of
how
like
they fit in.
the top
Yeah.
organizations,
Yeah.
or even the
Yep.
top families. There's probably families that we've never even heard of,
That's the other side of it. I mean, if we know of the names, are they really the true powerhouse? But some of the more ancient names like the Anjou in the West, I mean, that you might be getting a lot closer to the source. So I would sort of try and work it back that way. But again, we don't know because we're not on the inside.
Yeah, and you probably have, like you said, the banking powers. You probably have the Vatican, the City of London, and then probably Switzerland in modern times, right?
Well, the Vatican's banking was moved to Switzerland.
Yeah.
So it's controlled by the families.
That's actually an interesting fact, because I was gonna bring up the Vatican and the Pope, because you had mentioned that one of the royal families, the Borgies, what are their names?
Borgia?
Yeah,
Borgia.
Borgia, yeah. For the popes, do you, in your own belief, I don't know your whole eschatology, but for the false prophet, do you think that the false prophet will be coming out of the religious system like the Vatican, or do you think it might come from somewhere else? Are they fighting for that position as well, or?
Yeah, they're definitely fighting for that position. And there will be many false prophets, but when we talk about the false prophet, it's going to make the way for Antichrist. And Antichrist and false prophet with them, they're going to be the ones that are destroying Babylon. So that whole system gets destroyed when Antichrist comes to power. So could the false prophet come out of Babylon and perhaps the Catholic relationship through the branch of Vaticanus Hill versus the seven hills with the main center at Palatine Hill, I think, produce the false prophet out of that? Probably, but I think we're going to see things more like the vision of the Mary apparitions and with the initiates that were done in the 90s for six children to come out at certain dates with certain prophetic catastrophes to convert. It'll be kind of like that. But that brings about Babylon. So look at that type of support from the angelic realm for the false prophet. And with greater prophecies and greater signs and wonders and bringing fire down from the sky, and we'll have to also kind of emulate Elijah, just as Elijah will make the way for Christ. He needs a John the Baptist and an Elijah type of person as well. That's going to be the false prophet, but it's going to have that sort of pedigree to it too. So then you could make a suggestion that it might be from Judaism or a polytheist version of Christianity as it gets changed into the universal religion and part of it. So it's possible to come out, but we don't get a lot of information on where the false prophet comes from.
Yeah, he's a
So,
mystery.
yeah.
Could it be like a technology cult? Someone like Elon Musk, for example, like a transhumanist cult? Could it come out of that if a religion's based around that, Gary?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And when you look at polytheism, they're all knowledge cults. They're all knowledge religions. Like Gnosis is knowledge.
Yes.
So they're going to bring and harmonize science and technology back into the religion. So from that aspect, you create that scenario where it could be more technology sort of driven, right? Or
Yeah.
more scientist type driven. But there has to be such a strong religious nature there as well, for whatever religion Antichrist is going to introduce. It has to have some sort of connection in there from that aspect.
So if like the origins of modern science, if we're going back to the Royal Society and the mysticism within there, kind of like they used to embrace it, right? And then they kind of separated it, and then they're bringing it back together again. Do you have any idea of why that may be, per se, of why they kind of tried to do their best to completely distance themselves away from it, but now they're kind of be like, well, it was always like this, and this is how it always was, you know?
Well, it's kind of all of that. So, and in book one, I talk about how Enoch, son of Cain, receives the knowledge from Cain in the Gnostic and Masonic history that Adam received in Eden, and he takes those sciences and splits them into the seven sacred sciences, which that we know as the seven liberal arts today, and that is going to merge with the technology and angelic knowledge from the fallen angels or the gods, as it's understood in other societies, and that the mystical religion comes from that development of that knowledge. And to keep that knowledge that is so powerful, they want to keep it away from the mundane, translation, the Sethites, and create their own sort of bloodline sort of control for it that's going to merge with the Nephilim takeover of the kingships in it when they're created. So this is the beginning, and so they want to bring science back to its home religion, because the mystery schools, is basically where all of our education systems are kind of centered in, and it has all of the polytheism, that is surrounding everything that's taught in there. And that when you had the rise of the Roman Church, they had to make that split away from polytheism. Because of the pushback from the Roman Church. And so look at Galileo, for example, right? So they had to do something that was different. And so what they did was they created the Royal Society in 1662, and it took a few hundred years to get to the point where they could do this, where they could do science, but not have it equated with polytheism and not have the wrath of the Roman Church on them. So, And what that's designed to do, all of the sciences right from the beginning, was to do four basic things. One is to lead people away from God. Two is Amen. To discredit God and slander God. Third, and four is to honor their pantheon of gods. So they did that in plain sight, but said it was separate from the religions and sort of made it that way. And so they can, but it also freed them to introduce things like doctrines like evolution.
Yep.
Because they don't care. They don't believe in it. They don't.
Which Erasmus Darwin was a Freemason, you know, yeah. Darwin's uncle, you know, yeah. I mean, there you go.
Yeah. And was an avid fan of Eastern mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all used to accomplish their goals. So they created a theosophy that was designed to be the religion of the end time.
Yeah, agreed.
Sort of seen in Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. And he's the inspirational founder for the Royal Society, and his painting still hangs on that in the lobby there today. And that it was designed to be the harmonization back to its roots of science and religion in the end time. And then New Age morphs out of theosophy and its connection to Ariosophy just before that in World War II. And you know, coincidentally with this alien thing at Roslyn in about 1947.
Yeah.
But more, let's get away from the Nazis and let's rename it, rebrand it. Right. And so at some point in time, they're going to throw away all of that nonsense stuff, and they're going to, you know, be coming full center through these false prophets,
yeah,
that are going to have people convert to this mystical religion or be destroyed from the face of the earth. And I think we see a precursor to that is in like an early pang, is that the scientists, which will be coming home, have all of these prophecies of doom, whether or not it's nuclear war or it's global warming or it's disease or whatever. Yep. And I think that's what we're starting to see, is that type of apocalyptic nature, but it's going to have to take on that original religious sort of nature as well. And also understand that secret societies take their history back to being developed through the mystery schools before the flood. And that they have their patriarchs as their major patriarchs, as Tubal Cain, Nama, Jubal, and Jubal, sons of Lamech, who is another, this is of the Cain line versus the Sethian line, and that they're major patriarchs, but Enoch and Cain are their two major patriarchs, but Enoch sort of kind of higher because of the knowledge aspect of it, but Cain is more looked like as the original sort of priest or fisher king.
Yeah, you know, I one last thing I'll let you hop it back in, Jeremy, is you know, in 1 Timothy 6, 2021, I always like the King James translation of this specifically. Even though the word is knowledge, you know, Paul tells Timothy to guard himself against science so falsely called, right?
Yes.
Which
yes.
is a more modern translation of knowledge, but what we're dealing with now, it's very fitting.
Yes.
You know,
it's the wisdom of the world, right?
Yes, very much so. And then you have kind of like, you know, something we discussed last time is something I know you're extremely knowledgeable in, is you kind of like quantum mechanics kind of being, you know, the new form of scientism, of how they're kind of, you know, filling in the gaps of things they don't know and just kind of, you know, chalking it up to similar with the Big Bang theory, and kind of how you have the Jesuit Pierre D I can never pronounce his name Pierre D Teilhard Chardin, who was Barbara Marx Hubbard's mentor, you know, kind of pushing this magical mythos of cosmology. And then you have like this blending of science and mythology that most people are, like you mentioned, evolution, they're just as soon as, you know, they're born, they're now, you know, taught through the school system directly, you know, and they're almost inundated in it, and they're almost initiated into it. And so, you know, Alice Bailey talked about the world servers, how they were going to infiltrate the churches, and how they're going to, you know, infiltrate government and media, like the Seven Mountains, which originally was a Theosophy Bailey doctrine. And then they were going to, you know, initiate the masses to bring forth the externalization of the hierarchy, right? And you're seeing that where now they're like, well, you remember when we told you that science was separate from quote unquote religion and all these mysteries and stuff like that? Oh yeah, we lied about that. Actually, they're together. And science fiction was a way to make people be hook, line, and sinker from me. My favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future. You don't get more Gnostic technology, technology more than that, you know?
Exactly. And that you can change the times if you want,
Yes.
just as Antichrist will try and do.
Very much so.
Yeah, well, John, you kind of answered part of, or you kind of touched on part of the question that I had. But concerning theosophy, I mean, me and John and Laura Schrocki kind of dig into this a lot. But theosophy has infiltrated the Christian church hardcore through the NAR and Christian nationalist movement, right? So it's kind of crazy to see how, if theosophy is going to be the end times world religion, how they're sucking Christians into doing that. Because I mean, the NAR is basically Christian mysticism, and there's a ton of theosophical, like John mentioned, the Seven Mountain Mandate. And that Seven Mountain Mandate reminds me of either the seven spheres or the seven sacred sciences that they're trying to infiltrate. And in the name of Christ too, which in my opinion, the way that I see that is they've said some really crazy things, like they would kill other Christians for not being on board for this dominionist ideology that they have. And so what I see is that they're going to become a nuisance, and people are going to think that that's Christian. And so the world's going to come against Christians because of the act of these people doing these things in the name of God. You know what I mean? And but at the same time, they're casting their theosophical doctrines on everybody as well, and people are searching for that spiritual, mystical type of lifestyle, I guess, and truth. And so I see that the elite are using the NAR movement and Christian nationalist movement, which kind of go hand in hand, really, as a way to promulgate this end times doctrine, this end times religion.
We have to be very mindful of how much Christianity has been penetrated by polytheist moles who are there to create false doctrines, to get people to say and do things in the name of Christianity and to predict things and to confuse things to discredit humanity. And you can see them creating from inside a more of a revolutionary nature as we get closer that the world is going to hate because they are going to be classified as, apocalyptic, but, more like terrorists, right? So there's part of that's going on, but they're not, I don't think they're just going to rely on that. I think if you want to go right to the heart of Christianity and you want to be able to fold Christianity but not completely destroy it, you have to do something that you can fold it into the mystery religion and deceive so many people within Christianity. So look for them to do two things. They're going to have to discredit Paul. And we see a lot of that out of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and look for more of that type of
Amen,
revelation and
Gary. Yep. That's
information.
a big thing
Hebrew
right now.
roots.
Yep.
Yep.
And secondly, they're going to have to de-deify Jesus. Because as Paul said, Jesus and his resurrection is the single pillar that our faith is built on.
Yes.
And so they have to say that Jesus did not. Was not resurrected, and that there's several different ways that they'll be able, maybe they'll be able to do it, but they say they have evidence to be able to do that. So likelihood is they're going to say Jesus didn't die on the cross, and he survived.
Which
And
is a core
that's,
tenet of Islam.
which is a core tenet of Islam. And that if the world wants to come together, they have to make sure there isn't one Messiah that's already come. That's
Yep.
just so essential to them. And then they need to fold all of monotheism into mysticism. That monotheism, they will declare, went rogue. And it goes rogue in the time of Moses. Is certainly one of the strategies that my research revealed that they're going to try and do. because you have Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all interconnected at Moses. And what they're going to say, and we see parts of that as well, and there may be even more strategies than this, but this will be one of the central ones, is that Moses brought back the religion of Heliopolis to Israel, and that only with the monarchy did it go rogue into monotheism. And so if they can make that sort of connection, and present evidence, false probably, implanted a long time ago because it's a transgenerational plan, then they can sort of hit a lot of people of all three groups and bring them into this Babylon religion. And then if they discredited Paul at the same time, as he's the heretic, as the Essenes would call him. That he was the one that raised Jesus to deity status. And it's not true. I mean, you see it in the four gospels, but their argument is that. They'll be, well on their way to deceiving a lot. And then you'll have these false prophets that are out there. Convert to the true religion or be destroyed from the face of the earth. So there'll be a lot of unimaginable things that are going on. And then if you have the alien deception or coming along, or all of these entities that they're sort of inexplicable, and they'll say doesn't fit with biblical theology or biblical accountings, then the people who don't know the Bible well enough, they're going to be deceived.
Yeah, and you're going to have rising ecumenicalism within Christianity as well too. It's kind of as you're trying to move, Christians and into worldwide religion, right? They're going to try to say, oh, it's the differences don't matter. Let's all blend it all together, because we're all getting together in a one world religion where there is no separation, you know.
And there you see them working on it in the early stages. I mean, you have basic Christian religions working with the Vatican to do compromise doctrine for one. And then you see that same work going on between the Vatican and Islam to create a common sort of doctrine, which is a compromise on all ends. And you see the Vatican working with Buddhism in the same sort of way. And you see that this will be a compromise doctrine, but there's key things in the compromise that has to be there that changes any monotheist religion into the polytheist religion.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but they have this little setup in either Dubai or United Arab Emirates where there's the Vatican has a representative building there next to the Islamic representative building and also Judaism representative building.
Abu
And so you
Dhabi.
can, so you can see that whole ecumenical movement like really picking up at this time, which is pretty crazy because what it signals to me is that I feel like the Pope might not be this Pope, but a Pope will be that false prophet to be like, hey, this is the Antichrist. I'm not the Antichrist. They're going to say, he's going to say that this is the Christ. And it's going to, if you've already conjoined these other religions, monotheistic religions, like close enough and got them to a certain point, they're all going to accept whoever the Pope is saying is the Christ. And I say that because, I mean, when it comes down to it, the Pope is literally the most like powerful religious figure right now on earth. So if he says it and can compromise and be like, this is the Christ, this is the Christ, people are going to believe it.
And if you keep Jesuit control over the papacy, you have a polytheist society that interprets everything through the seven sacred sciences, controlling it. They're going to continue to change doctrine and move in that sort of direction. And that, but I still think that they're not the one that's going to be the dominant power in the end. I think they're going to be a significant part of it. And
Yeah, I
that
would agree.
and I think that if we look at the seven hills that Babylon is going to sit on, Vaticanus Hill was outside the seven hills. It was a branch of Palatine Hill. with the Sibylline prophecies, and Palatine Hill was understood in the Roman times as the seat of idolatry and the seat of Satan. So I would look for them to be a significant player, but a branch of that. And it's interesting that in the old Etruscan religion, that Vaticanus Hill was a branch of the Sibylline prophecies, time of the Etruscans that predate the Romans, and that we still have that possible play that's coming again in the end time. Now, you can make an argument that there's seven hills in Constantinople. I don't disagree with that. But what we do know is that the Roman Empire is closely associated with the religion and the old Roman Empire as coming out of those ashes. So I think there's a relationship there that we need to understand. But when we see not only the Mary apparitions that have been going on all around the world, we're now hearing about apparitions, and I need to get closer to it, of Isis. We see apparitions of other mother goddesses. Hathor is another one. And I don't know how often that's going on in countries we don't get much information out of, but you could be seeing similar kinds of apparitions playing to their polytheist belief system, just as Mary is being used to play to the Christian belief system through the Christian church or the Roman church.
Yes.
Right. Well, yeah, it's so very complex and deep, and it's so fascinating to learn about all this stuff and to dive deep. I wanted to ask you concerning your new book, is there anything in there that you previously didn't know? Like, is there any new information that you were just very surprised to learn about that you incorporated in your new book?
I did most of the research for it through book one. I did more research to go deeper on some things for book two. One of the things that I did add in was the Hyksos and the Amau and the Shamau, as they interconnect with Egypt and Israel and the time of the Exodus, and it'll have an interesting effect in book two as well. So I do put out a lot of new information that I didn't have in book one. Some of the things that, you know, I talked about, like the Thelemic tree or the Jesuits, I didn't finish the Jesuits. I put them into this. But nothing that, no, I think it was more that if I was going to do a book, I wanted it that it would be mostly like 90% new information and additional information, so it wouldn't be redundant, but more for a handbook for Christians. And that what it really did do is, could I put down a kind of chronology in end time prophecy that I like to talk about regularly and actually physically write a larger one. You can't do it all, but I lay down a chronology using how I approach eschatology. And it lays down the information that I think people need to start understanding how things are going to be shaping up. I'm not a prophet. I'm just putting the prophecy together.
Right, yeah, and you do that very efficiently, in my opinion. Your first book was incredible, so I'm definitely looking forward to your second book. Is there anything about the Committee of 300 that you would add to cap off some important information about them? Like, I guess their role in well, you already kind of mentioned that. Is there anything that you can think of about the Committee of 300 that people should definitely know about?
No, just that where they fit and how influential they are in so many of the economic organizations that they all report back to them. And they're that center that is dealing with that to help bringing about, you know, world government. So the G20 organization with, you know, their sponsored sort of leaders, they're going to report back in there as well. If you look at most of the imagery that comes out of the Committee of 300, it's Greek, and they are sort of like 300 invisible ones, as they would call themselves. But that's more reflective of the 300 angels. And so they also have kind of a sort of a religious sort of aspect that the cult of Dionysius or Dionysius, depending on how you want to reflect on that, is very, very important, as well as the Sibylline religion and prophecies and that oracle nature. And then they also mix in the cult of Isis as well. So those are three things that I kind of noticed about that they will be introducing those types of, I think they'll be introducing some of those religious type of views more in the economic side as they try and harmonize everything into this ancient universal religion that I like to call Enochian mysticism. So from Enoch, son of Cain. So yeah, it's really hard to peel back the onion on that organization. So you really have to, have a lot of different sources to get a good feel for who they are and why there's so many of them. But it's the money, and that's the organization that's about the money of the world and how they hoard the wealth and how they don't really want to share it.
So I know that you mentioned the Sibylline prophecies a couple times so far. For anybody who doesn't know, can you give a brief explanation of what the Sibylline prophecies are?
Yeah, she's it's a proto-Greek religion and it's proto-Rome religion. It's the religion of the Indo-Aryans and giants, or giants. You could call them either or. And it's the sort of basis of for Zoroastrianism as well, as they started to take that early post-Diluvian religion out. And she's like a queen of heaven. And there's many queens of heavens in many of the cultures. That's one of them, but it's the prophet side of the Sibyllines that is very, very important. And they moved the statue of the Sibylline that was worshipped in Greece back to Rome, in the time of Hannibal. And they had the Book of the Writings for their country, but they to get the full protection, they felt they needed to bring things back to Rome. This is in the time of the Roman Empire, obviously. And but its history goes back to the original hills of Vaticanus Hill and Palatine Hill, and that they had these book of prophecies that they needed to study and to follow that was written down in it. But there was also prophets that come out of that that were relied on by their early rulers. And so when the Bible tells us about religion and false prophets, just as you would have a similar thing that, say, Elijah fought against with the false prophets of Baal, this is what is coming. And we need to understand that these prophets are going to have the power of the fallen ones behind them, and they're going to be very, very impressive in how they deceive people. So, and that interconnection with the Beast Empire into Palatine Hill and the other six hills there is going to be very, 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 very important in my belief system. But it's going to take catastrophes and contrived catastrophes to bring about the change that they're going to need to do to bring that about. But we know Babylon is mentioned as a city nine times in the book of Revelation. So it's more than just a universal religion. It is a location as a city as well. And it is a beast system and is a geopolitical network. So it has all of those other components that will be working together with Babylon as it pulls together. So the Sibylline prophecies I spent a little bit of time on just to sort of make those kind of connections for people to be kind of aware of in book two. So I do talk about that. But only from how we want to understand Babylon, so we can understand what Babylon means to the polytheists.
Great answer, great answer. John, you got anything to add or ask?
Not specifically on that train of thought, no.
Okay. So is it Sibylline prophecies, because I've never dove into them, but does it have anything to do with like the working that basically to try to bring the world back to the golden age and the return of the gods and all that stuff, or does it have something to do with more of like world order?
Well, both, yeah.
Both? Okay.
But it's about bringing about that new world order and what comes afterwards. And in the Sibylline prophecies, whether or not they're counterfeit or not, some of the ones that I've read, they actually have an accounting of the destruction of Babylon.
Oh
It's,
wow.
yeah.
Like a future destruction of the Babylon?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
And
That's interesting.
it's very, very similar to the Revelation account.
Yeah, and you
Wow.
had the
So,
early church fathers writing about them as well too, and you also have like kind of like pseudo accounts as well too.
yeah. And so when I decided whether or not I wanted to put it into book two or not, I had to do some more research on it and get more historical sort of veracity to why it's important to understand this, and whether it's that is the main proponent or something like that. That's, hopefully people will understand it for why I put it in there. Because you have different types of oracles throughout the mystical religions. You have the oracles of Delphi, for example, and they're in all different. So it's like that. So what is the most sort of kin relationship to a revived Roman Empire and the prophet, the oracle and prophecy side? So that's what I decided to do. And when we look at, religions like the Baalim, that's just a sister religion or the same religion that was in Greece or Rome or other locations. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's good for context, and to understand a little bit more of the apocalyptic nature of the polytheists.
Yes, and I always remember the Shepherd of Hermas, the part where Hermas was asking the angel, is this, I remember him asking, is this Sibyl? And then it was later an allegory for the church, right?
Yeah.
But it always reminds me of that every time anybody ever, for some reason or another, anybody ever
Yeah.
talks about it, just for some reason, just reminds me of that line. So
Now, does this do these Sibylline prophecies have do they connect with Virgil in any way?
not that I'm aware of. No, I don't
Okay,
see.
because I know that he's a, I mean, he was a poet for in like the first century Rome,
Yeah.
but he was also they read it, did the kings at the time wrote read his poets like they were
Yep.
prophecies, and that was one of the things he talked about was bringing back the golden age and the end times,
Right.
basically
Yep.
the return of the gods. So I
Yeah.
thought that was kind of similar.
He would be very familiar with the Sibylline prophecies. So he would be probably using that as the base.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, thank you very much, Gary. Is there anything that you else you'd like to add before we promote your book one more time?
No, I think we covered off things well, and hopefully we gave people a little bit better understanding of how the hierarchy works. So many people have different sort of versions. Is it the Jesuits that's the power and control of everything? It's the bloodlines who created the Jesuits. So you have to understand where organizations sort of fit in. And it the pyramid model, you just can't, you run out of space in that pyramid to put everything in. So you need something larger to look at the larger organizational structure. So, and who knows, it might be disinformation, but that's what my research, and I verified it many times with different sources that, and you wouldn't get a whole lot more information, but you might get a hint, maybe look more in this direction to help your understanding on it, because they're not really wanting to give this kind of information out.
Right. Have you ever just quick question, have you ever read John Coleman's book on the Committee of 300 by any chance?
Yes, I did. I did read his book. Yeah.
Was it good?
That was this. Okay. There's some piece, some little, there's some nuggets in there, and then
Some things you
there's,
can't verify, some
yeah,
kind of like some bridges that were made that can't be verified. So
yes. So, but yeah, I did read it, and I think I quoted him a couple of times, but not as a large source. So, only things that I would have verified elsewhere that he had put in there. I didn't have that high degree of comfort that I could use him without another source
There
on
are
it.
some conjectures written in his book. We'll just say
Yes.
that.
Yeah, I know you can get that book on the CIA website or read it for free on the CIA website as well. Not that that's, I mean, people think that's kind of crazy, but there's a bunch of obscure books that are on the CIA website, to be honest. So before you go, I wanted to ask one question concerning the Jesuits, because I know you've done a ton of research on the Jesuits. There's a claim that the Jesuits started, what's his name?
Ignatius of Loyola.
Yes, and that he was a crypto Jew. Is there anything that confirms that he was a crypto Jew, or
No, he was Basque.
okay, that's good to know, because I know that's a huge theory in the conspiracy world. So, all right, glad I got in any more questions, sir.
And a royale of the Basque bloodlines.
Oh wow, that's significant, that's for sure. All right, John, you got anything else, buddy?
I have nothing else for Gary. The lot of the things that he talks about, and of course I've heard you on numerous interviews and everything. Your brain and I, we must be have very similar personality types, I think, because I think our brains work very similar in the way that we analyze and disseminate information. So a lot of the things that you talk about, it's nice to hear, because a lot of, especially, you have polemics against Gnosticism, you have polemics against Theosophy, but you're also warning, Christians against, like you said, the denial of Paul, which is something that's very much in the, on the rise, and something that I think very much will play a role into the end times for sure. Because yeah, you see a lot of the Hebrew roots, kind of like deconstruction, for lack of a better words, of people's faith, kind of rejecting Paul, because once I always say the spirit of the Antichrist hates Jesus first, but then also hates Paul, second to Jesus, because of kind of like once you devolve Paul away, then you start shaving off the gospels, right? And it's kind of like a linear pattern of that. And there's a lot of, sadly, a lot of Christian apologists that just won't talk about that. And it's on the rise. It's majorly on the rise.
It is. It is. And it's it and I think it just has to be a central line of their attack if they're going to get Christianity to crumble, but not totally destroyed, so that they can bring it into the mystical religion. It's just a key part,
Yeah,
not the one, but a very important part.
and I want to thank you for discussing that, because like I said, there's many Christian apologists that sadly won't mention it at a time where I think it's very much necessary to do so. As we see that evangelicism is somewhat working in Israel, where it wasn't working previously beforehand, we're now seeing kind of like the reverse with or the inverse, should I say.
And I would ask people to be very careful with the Western Essene movement as well. I've gone head to head with them a few times, and they do the same thing. They chop away everything that Paul said because he's the heretic. Then they chop away each of the gospels, and then they throw away most of the Old Testament.
I will say, as a former Gnostic, most Gnostics have a very high value or place or esteem for the Essenes.
Yes,
And you do
they
have
do.
Gnostics who venerated Paul, but you also had Gnostics, Christian Gnostics, that did not like Paul, the
Yes.
more the Judaizer sects.
Yes.
And so, yes, so I would definitely, I'm glad you mentioned that too. Anything that tries to say that Jesus was an Essene, or anything like that, you're definitely, even in modern times, you'll see that in New Age beliefs like the Korean Gospel of Jesus Christ,
I spent a lot of time on the scenes in book one. What I probably should have put in book one was more of the Christian history side, but I wanted the polytheists to talk about them in their own words, as where they fit in and stuff like that. So I have a document for people, and I understand that people want to look at Jesus as an Essene. That's part of the misinformation. I have a document if people get a hold of me through my website to ask for the Essene document, and I'll give you the historian's view of the Essenes, the church fathers. I'll link it back to biblical passages about the Essenes. And it's quite an eye-opening deception. And the word Nazarene does not root in the same Nazarene of the Essenes.
Amen.
Their word goes back to Natsar, not from Nazareth. And Natsar basically means in Hebrew to hide the hidden knowledge, to guard that knowledge as watchers. And this is the knowledge of the fallen angels that they wouldn't give out names of, even upon torture and death, that they worshipped.
I guess one last question to that, Gary, something is, I've done a lot of research in the Nag Hammadi Library as far as like the preservation and translation and propagation of those scrolls seem to be primarily Rockefeller funded, especially through one of the major Rockefeller scholars, Elaine Pagels, and her husband, Hein Pagels, that form their own, you know, kind of like new age science group, the Reality Club, but that's a whole nother discussion. Okay. Yep. But what about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Because I heard you mention them earlier, and you don't have to, you know, you've been generous with your time, and I want to thank you for it very much. Yep. But I've always been kind of cautious in some ways about it.
We have to be cautious on the Dead Sea Scrolls. So obviously, ones that verify the Bible or from the Bible, fine. And I'm not saying not to read the Dead Sea Scrolls Gospels. Understand there's a large amount of Gnosticism that's in there, but some of them, you know, aren't all that bad. But you have to read each one individually if you're going to do it. And then where it diverts from what Scripture says or contradicts it, that needs to be a major red flag. If it's adding more information on biblical premises that are in the same direction, value-wise, principle-wise, and belief-wise, then, you know, that's fine. So read it with that sort of critical analysis. Measure everything against that you read outside the Bible from what's in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I do that even with the Book of Enoch, where it strays. Yes. That's got to go. And
And I was going to say, as a former Gnostic, you're right, because I'm glad you say that, because there are parts of the Book of Enoch where I'm like, you know, kind of the accreting to wisdom as a separate being, not so much as allegorizing it as a female like happens in Proverbs, as well as also saying Phanuel, the angel over salvation, right, is a very interesting turn too. So I'm glad you're actually saying that, because there are a few, you know, there's some Christian apologists, especially in modern days, who would not warn against such things. It's admirable.
Yeah, and I like it. You know, 95 to 99% of it I like, and I know there's was an original Hebrew manuscript, because we get words that only go back to Hebrew for understanding. So, but we don't have that complete Hebrew manuscript, only pieces of it. And so we have to be careful with it. So where it diverts, understand it. There's a lot of good context in there. So, and I like it and I use it a lot, but you know, where it's wrong, it's wrong. It just have to be. That's one of my principles, is you got to measure it against what the Bible says.
Amen. Amen.
What would you say, Gary, about the, I think it's the Book of Jasher. I don't know. So I heard somebody talking about how the Book of Jasher was basically the ones that we have now, you know, the copies that we have now. The manuscripts for that was found in, like, I don't know, sometime after, like 5 AD.
Yeah, it's we don't have an ancient, again, Hebrew manuscript, or we don't have an old dating that would be acceptable. There's a lot of mysticism that's in the Book of Jasher, and the passage that's quoted in the Bible about what's in the Book of Jasher isn't in the modern Book of Jasher. So in book one, I didn't use book Jasher for a reference. I only used Jewish legends from Ginsburg, because what we have there is mostly legends, Jewish mystical legends that are in there. And there's things that are out of sorts with the history and the names and stuff. And there's a lot of issues with, I have a document on the Book of Jasher with some of the issues to be aware of, just as I'd have one on the Book of Enoch as well.
All right. Well, thank you, man. We appreciate your time and coming on here with us again for the third time. And I'm sure we're going to have you back probably 150 more times, or as long as we're alive.
Yep.
So
Perfect.
we thank you, man. And if you want, real quickly, you can plug your website, your books, anything that
Yes.
you need.
Yeah, so the best way to get a hold of me or to buy my book is through the website. There's a contact the author icon there, and my email website email address is genesis6conspiracy@gmail.com. So that's how it will come through and how I will respond to you based off of that email. So if you're interested in a document that I have, just name it by topic and ask. You can ask about other topics as well. If I got one, I'll send that as well. But I will answer your question. It might take me 2 months to get back to you. I'm trying to get that back down to 3 to 4 weeks. The book launch has put me a little bit behind, so I'm working away on that now. And you can also get a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of book one and all 84 chapters of book two. You can buy multiple books and get a discount if you do. I don't have it set up yet to be bundled between the two, but if you wanted one of each, for example, just order two of one, send me an email, tell me you want one of each, I'll ship you one of each. They're both the same price, or whatever the mix on the quantities that you want. That's how you can get, and it's all on savings on shipping is that I pass right on. And so if you wanted to purchase a signed copy, you'd go to the buy now for book one or book two. And if you're in Canada, there's a Canadian page. If you're in the US, there's a US page. Anywhere else in the world, there's an international page. And that's where you order from. And I'll send you a signed copy. And if you wanted to link over to Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, or BarnesandNoble.com, I have those links that takes you right to the books for each. And the Kindle version link as well for each is on there. And the end of June, there should be a link up for audio for book one, and it'll be available on Amazon through ACX as well. And then by September, book two will be up there.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's great news, to be honest with you. I love audiobooks. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a tough project. So I still got my fingers crossed. I got 21 chapters to review on what was done so far for book one. So, but they look like they're up for the project. So.
Any last words, John?
Just God bless everyone who's listening, and God bless Gary. I'm glad to have you back on, brother. And everybody out there, stay in the word and stay close in prayer with the Lord.
Terrific. Thank you.
Amen. All right. God bless you guys. We love you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Buy Their Fruits. May the Lord bless the giver, the gift, and the receiver.
Hey listeners, it's Nick from Kevlar Joe's Coffee Company. I want to invite you to try something new. Here at Kevlar Joe's Coffee Company, we have a bold and slow-roasted coffee that is 100% organic and ethically sourced. There are no pesticides or fungicides from the plantations we import our coffee from, and it's all single-sourced too. We have light, medium, and dark roast. Even decaf coffee as well to satisfy whatever kind of coffee you drink. We also have a variety of flavored coffees for you to try, including our hazelnut and apple pie flavored coffees, which are both big sellers. You can order our coffee at www.kevlarjoes.com. You can also follow us at Facebook, Instagram, or X for Kevlar Joe news, deals, and your daily dose of coffee-related memes, so make sure to like and follow our pages. And I'll leave you with this, listener. The world isn't a safe place right now, and it seems like it's always teetering on the edge. But don't forget, like it says in Matthew 5:14, you are the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill and cannot be hid. Let your light shine before all men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So be bold, be humble, and be Kevlar.